This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and my guest today is Jeff Birmingham. Jeff is a co-founder of Peak Capital Partners, which owns more than $1 billion worth of affordable student and family apartment properties across the United States. Jeff is also a founder and managing partner of Peak Ventures, a seed stage venture fund focused on tech startups here in the Mountain West region. Jeff, thank you for joining us on The Bottom Line.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks, Doug.
Hey, so let's start with real estate. You guys got started in 2007.
We did.
Tell us about that. What was going on then that you felt that would be a good time to get into real estate?
Yeah, I had started a technology company as an undergrad at BYU. And after growing that for a number of years, sold it to a NASDAQ-listed company and took the proceeds of that exit and rolled it into real estate. This is in 03, 04, 05 when things were kind of straight up. So really bullish on the market at that time. However, in 06 and 07, started to see some cracks in the appreciation in real estate. So started talking to a couple of my really good buddies who were Ivy League MBAs. They'd gone back east and gotten studied in real estate and were working for real estate investment firms. And we started commiserating, you know, on nights and weekends and talking about how we felt like there would be a pullback in real estate and decided to start a firm to buy distressed real estate, kind of pre-downturn, really. So that's kind of the genesis, the high-level genesis of Peak Capital Partners.
So was it a committed capital fund? How much money did you originally raise for Peak?
Yeah, it was completely bootstrapped. So my two partners' names are Jamie Dunn and Jeff Danley. One was living in Charlotte, North Carolina, the other in California. They had started to see the cracks as well, and we really got together without any capital, Doug, to be honest with you. I had a little bit of money from my exit and then selling some of the real estate that I owned. Jeff and Jamie had done some real estate on the side as well, so had a little bit of money. But really, we just started with our own at first. And then we raised, then we started raising. When we started doing projects, we started raising. We would invest our own capital alongside LP or limited partner capital from really just high net worth individuals.
Okay. And what was your first project?
Our first project was actually a little deal up at Powder Mountain, Utah. Up at Powder Mountain.
Love Powder Mountain.
That's a great place. Yeah, we're in love with it too. All my kids learned to ski up there, and we have a place up there. We love going up there. It's a good place.
So was it a residential? Was it commercial? Was it a apartment
It was. It
complex?
Was a distressed condo deal that we lent some money on. It happened right before the downturn. The downturn occurred. It was a very hairy situation. It was very challenging. But we were able in the end to kind of rescue this money, provide a little bit of return for this investor group. They were so impressed because of the downturn that they said, we will invest. It was about $1 million check, I think their first check. They said, we'll invest 10x that next in the next deal. Because we were able to rescue it, return capital. We didn't make any money, to be honest with you. The principals, Jeff, Jamie, and I didn't. And they were kind of impressed with that integrity, impressed with the ingenuity to get the money back as the real estate market was cratering. And true to their word, you know, they invested that much and more kind of in the coming years to help us grow a significant real estate portfolio.
So it was a tough time to start a real estate fund, right?
It was,
I mean, you wanted to target distressed properties. You had no idea how much supply of that was about to come on the market. Probably one of the more challenging real estate cycles that we've had. Certainly in my recent memory and probably in my lifetime.
Yeah.
So in hindsight, do you think it was good that that was at the beginning of your journey? Or if you could have controlled things, would you have avoided something like that altogether?
I mean, I think in the perfect situation, which never happens in entrepreneurship, so scratch that, or very rarely, I should say, happens and only happens probably because of serendipity. We would have started maybe a year or two later because we pre-timed the market a little bit. Does that make sense? We kind of got together waiting, you know, thinking that the market would turn, and it took a while for that to happen. But other than that, other than we went 2 or 3 years with zero income, zero income. Luckily, we had had some savings. We had had a couple of little exits maybe previously. And so we had some runway and were able to do that. But it was very lean first 2 or 3 years. But obviously what it led to was a lot of distressed property, as you know. I remember sitting with Jeff, Jamie, in a little office about the size of this, very small kind of 10 by 10 office, back to back to back. And we'd come in the office during the morning and we'd read like, Lehman fails. AIG is going on. And we were like, oh my goodness, like this is going to be maybe a lot worse than we realized. And we worried, of course, can we survive this? Or did we, you know, can we survive it? Will we make it? Yeah. In the end, what ended up happening is we've actually bought about $2.5 billion of real estate now. A lot of it during the first 3 or 4 years, what I mean by that is 9, 10, 11, 12, that has obviously we bought at a very good price, has appreciated very nicely, and that we're very, very happy with now. So the downturn, you know, was a benefit. We maybe pre-timed it a little bit, and it was scary in lean times for sure.
Yeah, you know, it's challenging just because, as you mentioned, you know, Lehman and AIG and what happened was credit became very, very tight. And, you know, we are now about 10 years on the other side of that crisis. So people forget, but, you know, very creditworthy businesses that had been around 20, 30 years that had long-term banking relationships were facing liquidity crisis just because their bank was pulling back a line that maybe that company had. A lot of businesses have seasonality to it, so they need some funding through the year. And they relied on that banking relationship for maybe a couple $1 million, and they've done that for 10, 15 years. All of a sudden, the bank's saying, sorry, we're not going to do that. We're calling in that loan. You're in a very financially leveraged and driven business. Yeah. How were you able to get the funding? You can't pay, I'm imagining you didn't pay 100% equities for these properties. You typically put in 20, 25% equity and you fund the rest. How were you able to get the capital for those deals, the debt?
Yeah, it's a great question. And we forget now after 10 strong years, we forget, it's easy to forget how scary it was 10 years ago. I mean, it was a scary time for everyone in business. Certainly in any financial industry, it was a very scary time. And it was not certain that Peak Capital would survive or make it. And so, but, you know, there are many answers, I guess, specifically to your question, Doug, but we just were scrappy and we bootstrapped. Again, we had a little bit of money. We were able to get some very high net worth investors, both in Utah and in California, that believed in us to invest. And we just started buying one property kind of at a time.
So that's the equity side, but typically there's a debt side of it. How were you able to get the debt during that time?
Yeah,
that's impressive.
Yeah, and our current, you know, $2.5 or so billion dollar portfolio, we have about 60% leverage. So we do have a lot of debt. We were able to just through the normal channels, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, we had a balance sheet and our investors had a balance sheet that allowed us to get some debt. There isn't, to be honest with you, a lot of barriers to entry in real estate. There is one big one, capital. Period. I mean, capital is the barrier to entry in real estate. So it's not, I don't want to make it sound easy to do that, but based on both our, what we had kind of done in the past, the savings we had had, and just who we were and our track record, what we studied, we were able to combine kind of our balance sheets with a couple of our early investors' balance sheets and were able to kind of start getting debt. And when, you know, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae kind of came back on and got back, quote unquote, in business and started lending again, we were there ready to acquire as many apartment complexes as we could. And also a local shout out, we own the largest kind of student housing complex at BYU. It's right south of campus. It's called The Village at South Campus. There's about 1,000 students at BYU. We built that property from the ground up, and Zions Bank, you know, Scott Anderson stood up and took a bet on us, kind of a small startup, and he lent us a significant amount of money, especially right now it wouldn't seem significant, but in 2011, coming out of the crisis, it seemed like a big deal. And he bet on us, and we built a beautiful complex down there that's gone very, very well and been a great success. But again, that seems easy today when everything's up and to the right and everyone's feeling good and capital's flowing. That was not an easy decision to make, and that felt a lot more risky in 2011, you know, 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah, so as you just said, it's 7 or 8 years since things started to get back to kind of a normal cycle. How long do you think we have in this cycle where things stay normal? Or are we still in the early innings, or are we in the later innings?
Yeah, obviously no one knows that, and I don't know that. You know, but here's what I've been telling people, but I've been telling people this for a year or two, is that I think we're in the 8th or 9th inning of a good bull run, but the score is tied. So we could go extra innings. And I think because I've been saying that for a year or two, I think we've started kind of going extra innings, right? We're kind of in the 10th inning. It's tied 2-2. And so the truth is, I have no idea the bull will continue to run. No one does. But I will say that immediately, things continue to be very positive. People are looking for homes. There's a shortage of affordable housing in a lot of the markets that we own in. And we continue to find good deals. Yields have been compressed, you know. It's harder to, we have to, and wherein in the early days, maybe we'd have to look at, you know, I don't know, 50 deals to find one we want to buy. Now maybe we're looking at 500 deals. But we still are finding deals. We'll buy several hundred million dollars worth of assets this year. We'll also dispose of several hundred million dollars of assets. And in fact, if this is interesting, the last 2 years, I would say the peak Capital Partners has been a net seller of real estate, meaning I think we've sold a little over $500 million worth of assets, and we've acquired about maybe $300 million worth. Okay. The last couple of years.
Yeah, no, you know, it's a question I get a lot. I'm in the stock market, and you know, the stock market's had a great run as well.
So, there how do you answer it, Doug? Give us your answer.
I liked your answer as well. I would say we're cautiously optimistic, mm-hmm. And I would agree with your assessment that, you know, we're certainly not in the beginning innings of the game, but at least in my business, the stock market does not tend to flatten or decrease based on the calendar.
Yeah,
it tends to do it based on activities. I think it's very similar in real estate. And that's where I want to go for my next question. In 2013, you gave an interview to the Daily Herald, a newspaper down in Utah County, and you were saying you were bullish at the time on real estate because you really thought inflation was going to take off.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've been fortunate. I mean, there was a lot of reason back then. There's a lot of reason today to think that inflation is going to take off. It hasn't taken place, but yet real estate has continued to do well. What were the drivers that have helped real estate from 2013 to now? Why has real estate, it's been a very nice asset class from a return standpoint. Why has it done so well over the last 5 or 7 years?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll answer it with kind of three ideas or three points. Not that this will cover everything or is all inclusive. But number one, obviously interest rates have really been in our favor, right? So we do borrow a lot of money. It's been a low interest rate environment, which has helped capital flow and has been beneficial to real estate owners, number one. Number two, 2008 to 12 was such a shock to the system that there was not capital in the market, like you said. And so there was not a lot of projects being approved or financed. And so you had households and families that were growing, but there's no new homes being built for them. There's no new apartment supply coming online. And so we're still kind of catching up with that, you know, 3 to 5 year kind of quiet period where there was not inventory being created for these new households. And so because of that now, and you know, that's reversing now, by the way, like that trend, we've now kind of caught up and there is a lot more supply coming online, but we've still been benefiting from kind of there's been an undersupply of homes and an oversupply of demand. And that's the third thing that I would say, actually, leads to the third thing, is in the markets we buy in. We don't buy in gateway cities or in coastal markets, per se. We buy in, like, secondary and tertiary markets such as, you know, Salt Lake City, Denver, Colorado, Dallas, Texas, Oklahoma City, Nashville, Raleigh, et cetera. So these are good, stable markets with the two drivers of multifamily are, it's very simple. It's jobs and population growth. And so it's people. And obviously these markets have both in-migration and of people. And then they've had more stable kind of economies and jobs. And so because of the markets that we've been buying in, it's just been a great time to buy in those markets. There's three ideas. I'm sure there's more.
It's a good answer. If you're just joining us this morning, our guest today is Jeff Burningham, the co-founder of two firms, one that owns over $1 billion in apartment complexes and another that does seed stage venture capital investments here in the Intermountain West. And we're going to switch to venture capital here in just a minute. But before I do, you've mentioned a couple times that you focus on affordable housing. And the definition of affordable, unfortunately, has changed quite a bit in the last 5 to 7 years as well. There's a lot of press here in Salt Lake City. The supply of what used to be affordable housing is now down quite a bit. As you think about affordable housing for folks, you mentioned the project you did in BYU, The Village. How do you think about setting the pricing? So it's a price that your clients can afford. It gives your investors a decent return, and it fits into the ecosystem.
Yeah, it's a good, really good question, Doug, and it's kind of a social issue, right? And I think it will increasingly be one here in the United States and certainly in Utah. I think for the kind of the first time in Utah's history, we have a rising generation that wants to stay here. And they can stay here because there's a vibrant economy that has jobs that... I'll say, like, I have four younger kids at home. They're all excited to stay in Utah. I assume when I went to school at BYU in the late 90s and early 2000s, there wasn't nearly as much happening. Now, I stayed because I started my own businesses, but most of my friends, like Jeff and Jamie, my partners, for instance, they left BYU because there weren't the jobs here to keep people here. Anyways, the point of this is that we have the first generation in Utah of people that want to stay, and we do not have enough affordable housing to house them. And so that becomes really a question for local municipalities and cities to approve and to help facilitate the way for some affordable housing, which means higher density. It means apartment complexes that a lot of cities and communities don't want in their neighborhoods. That's fine. Their kids are going to have to go live out in Tooele, Utah, or they're going to have to go out to Eagle Mountain, Tooele, to the fringes. They're going to get pushed out unless we provide more affordable housing. So, and really, Doug, sir, it's a supply and demand question. I mean, we try to charge a market rate for a nice kind of affordable, safe, clean apartment home. You know, the market sets that. And what the market sets is based on the supply and the demand, obviously. And right now there is an over demand and under supply of affordable housing, not only generally in the United States, but certainly here along the Wasatch Front.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge, as you point out, and hopefully the civic leaders are getting ahead of this. I think the economy that we have, the jobs that we have to be grateful for today, there were good decisions that were being made 5 or 10 years ago by our state legislatures, our civic leaders. And I know this is on everybody's radar screen, and I hope that there's something down the road that makes it where people that want to stay have a place, a safe place.
So do I. I hope our local leaders understand this problem and are taking it seriously. I'm not sure that they are, but I hope they are. I hope they understand.
We've had some guests. I know it's on their short list, and they probably need to collaborate, and they probably are collaborating with business leaders like yourself that know a lot about real estate to say, okay, how do we solve this issue? Because it is going to take that type of partnership.
Yeah.
I want to switch over to your venture capital work. But before I do, I just want to ask, what do you see as next on the real estate side for Peak? So you mentioned right now you're more net sellers than buyers. You're still buying, but you're
Correct.
Selling more than yourself. You're selling more than you're buying. What's the next 10 years look like for Peak?
Yeah, I think there are two things that are happening in our business for those that are interested. One, so we used to raise money kind of like I said, kind of one-off, Doug, from high net worth individuals or family offices or even opportunity funds. We've kind of changed in the last couple of years to a fund model. We are now raising real estate funds. So we currently raised a couple of funds. And so that's a change in our business where we're raising larger and larger funds to deploy and buy more assets.
You used to get investors project by project.
Correct.
And now you're saying you're going to invest in a fund, you're going to give so much money, and then you're going to get exposure to all the deals that you do within that fund.
Correct. So we raise a couple hundred million dollar fund, buy, let's just say, 20 assets, and those assets are kind of together in the fund. So you have diversification, geographically, as well as, if one property struggles but 10 do well, you have some kind of buffer there. So that's just a change in our strategy a little bit. It's normal for a firm as they grow up to kind of become a fund manager to raise funds. The second thing I'd say that's maybe more interesting and innovative and is we are slowly but surely branching out to other, we will add other Peak entities to the platform, like Peak Ventures, which is unrelated to real estate, and we'll talk about. But there are other real estate related opportunities that we've been looking at and have started actually investing in and will continue to invest in, including, I might mention, we are very interested in the home sharing space and how apartments are going to work as how home sharing and apartments are going to intersect and how they will work kind of together, which has not happened previously. So I think that's an interesting problem that we've been looking at for a number of years and are actually now working on.
What is home sharing?
Home sharing like Airbnb, Airbnb, you home share. What's interesting is we house about 25,000 families across the country in our apartments every night. There's a certain percentage of those that are being home shared, against kind of a contract, but they're being home shared. So let's say 5% of our units are, so that's roughly, 1,000, or 1,200 or so units every night in our portfolio are being home shared. This is increasingly happening to apartment owners. Now, in contracts as they're written now, that's not supposed to happen. There are insurance and liability reasons why that can't happen. What we've always kind of been a very innovative and entrepreneurial group, as you know, Doug. And what we're interested in is how can apartments and home sharing work together and in conjunction as the sharing economy continues to ramp up, as millennials and other renters are interested in the ability to home share, how can we, instead of kind of fight against that, how can we facilitate that, make that easy, make that very appealing and interesting to a very important subset of our renter base? And is that helpful?
It is. It'll be fun to see how that plays out. When Airbnb, I love technology. I love gadgets. So I knew about Airbnb in the early days. I was one of the early travelers. People thought I was nuts to go stay in a stranger's home. Now, of course, we all do it and we love it.
Yep.
But I told my wife at the time, this changes the value of homes. This changes the value of apartment buildings in areas that get a lot of business and tourist travelers, like San Diego, San Francisco. You can now afford to pay higher rents in those areas if, when you go away for a vacation to go camping in Yosemite, you can rent your place out and get extra income. And I think that's part of the reason in some, I don't think it's driving what's happening here in Salt Lake City, but in some towns. I do think that's why affordable housing has become more challenging.
Yeah.
Just because it's made those properties more valuable. And I love the fact you're thinking about that now. I'm going to be interested to follow Peak and see what you guys come up with there. Yeah. Let's transition and talk about your venture capital work. You launched Peak Partners, the real estate side, in 2007. I know your first fund was $23 million. You went on to raise a $50 million fund after that. When did you formally get your first fund together to start investing in venture capital? And what was it about that space that made you say, let's start doing this?
Yeah. So we started Peak Capital Partners, the real estate owner, in 2007. The first venture fund, Peak Ventures is the name of the firm and the fund, was started in 2014, so about 4 or 5 years ago. There are a number of reasons why this happened, two of which are, one, I'm an entrepreneur. I started a technology company as an undergrad at BYU. Like I told you, I love technology. I love entrepreneurship. I don't sit still very well. I'm always looking at innovating and doing new things. And so when the real estate started really cash flowing, I went to my partners, Jeff and Jamie, and said, hey, let's start investing with some like local entrepreneurs, such as Sid Cromanhook, my partner at Peak Ventures now, and there were others. Let's start angel investing into some deals. This is, I don't know, 2011, 12, 13, something like this. And so we became a fairly significant angel investor, investing, you know, several million dollars of our own money into several local startups. Some of those went very well. One of those was Owlet, for instance. If you know this,
just announced a big round. Yep. It's the baby monitor to keep babies safe.
Yep, right out of BYU. There were several different companies. And so we started doing that, and several of our LPs or our investors on the real estate side said, hey, I hear you guys are writing angel checks, you know, into these startups. We want to do that with you. And for honestly 6 to 12 months, I said, no, this is just something we're doing very casually off the side of our desk. You know, it's the underwriting's not super thorough. We're not ready, blah, blah, blah. But over a year or so, I was kind of convinced that we should start a fund. And so we brought on our venture partner, Sid Cromanhook, and we launched Peak Ventures in 2014. That's a little more specific. At a very high level, I felt, as an entrepreneur myself in 2001, I went to all the local kind of entrepreneurs, did that kind of local roadshow, and I found, at least at that time, that the capital that was here was maybe not that friendly to entrepreneurs. And so I felt that Peak Ventures could be friendly capital to entrepreneurs and be helpful capital from people who had built businesses themselves. It was kind of our turn to kind of give back and hopefully invest in the next wave of entrepreneurs and help them scale up. So that was the genesis and the high level thinking of how kind of Peak Ventures came together. Our first fund was $23 million. Our second fund was $57 or $8 million or so. And we're investing out of our second fund still right now.
Okay, great answer. Let's take a short break. When we return, we'll continue the conversation with Jeff Burningham, a co-founder of both Peak Capital Partners, a real estate investment company, and Peak Ventures, a seed stage venture firm.
You're listening to The Bottom Line on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Jeff Burningham. He's the co-founder of two firms, one that owns over $1 billion in apartment complexes, and another that does seed stage venture capital. So before break, you were telling us the genesis for Peak Ventures. You mentioned your venture partner, your partner in that endeavor, Sid Cromanhook. How did your path and Sid's cross? Sid was an entrepreneur himself. He was involved in a company that got bought by Chegg, publicly held company. Nice win. Was it Zinch? Yeah, Zinch. How did you and Sid hook up?
Yeah, so like I said, I was a tech entrepreneur, won the BYU kind of business. It was called the Business Plan Competition in 2001. Sid kind of was 5 years behind me and did the same thing. So I knew him kind of via two ways. One, entrepreneurship at BYU. And then two, although he was a couple years younger than me, there's an entrepreneur founders program at BYU that I was a part of and we had met there. Secondly, and maybe more importantly and fun, we were both former college basketball players, love basketball. And so we actually played pickup two or three times a week for a number of years before we ever spoke anything about business. In fact, when Sid was starting up Zinch, right before we started Peak Capital Partners, and he spoke to me about Zinch, and he actually came into our office and pitched Jeff, Jamie, and I. We were focused on real estate, so didn't invest in Zinch. We should have.
Unfortunately,
yeah, we should have. But we had several experiences like that, Doug, which is one of the reasons we launched a venture fund, as we would see these great entrepreneurs like Sid and others that we could not back because we did not have a vehicle and we were so focused on real estate. And that's when we made the strategic decision about 5 years ago for me to step away from the day-to-day operations of real estate. I still am very involved strategically, kind of at a chairman level, but then to move, I moved and put my time into kind of the day-to-day operations of standing up a new venture fund, which is not easy. So anyway, Sid and I knew each other via entrepreneurship at BYU, and because we love to be on the same team in basketball and win.
That's pick a up fun games. Story. Yeah. It's amazing how these casual encounters can make a difference.
Yeah.
So what were your friends telling you when, you know, you guys at this successful real estate fund? They're very different animals. You know, entrepreneurship is all encompassing, very time intensive. I would argue in real estate, a lot of it is making good decisions.
Yep. It's much not more as programmatic.
It's not as operationally intensive. So they're very different. Yep. Choosing great real estate projects is very different than choosing great entrepreneurs and great startups. What were your friends telling you as you were starting to think about maybe we should launch a venture fund?
Yeah, I think that those that knew me well were really excited about it. They felt like I had the background. They were excited about Sid joining the team. We have a number of other very capable and great team members, John Mayfield, Diogo Mira, Steve Hale, et cetera. And so they were excited about this new kind of venture fund launching. And to be honest with you again, Doug, I really view myself as an entrepreneur much more than I do a private equity guy or a real estate guy, or to be honest with you, even a venture guy. I am an entrepreneur. So you ask about the future of Peak, I guarantee there will be more innovation and more peaks, so to speak, stood up on this platform. And so for me, it was very natural to kind of go to venture. I think some in the community, at least at first, were maybe a little doubtful. What do these real estate guys know about venture? But again, it's been 5 years. We were the first money into Podium. We were the first money into a number of companies that have...
Podium's huge success. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, they've gone... We invested in Eric and Dennis when it was two guys. They just opened a building, a big building, right off I-15, right south in Lehigh. They have about 400 employees now. So we've seen them go from 2 to 400 employees. And there are a handful and a number of other, I hesitate to name because I know I'll forget some, but there are a number of other really exciting startups that we've kind of backed. We've shepherded to some success. We hope that we've been helpful to these entrepreneurs. We are certainly an ancillary part. We are not the business. They are the business. They are the stars of the show. But we hopefully can play a supporting and helpful role, especially at the beginning in Utah when still, again, even 5 years ago, there was much less capital in Utah than there is even today for early stage venture. And so we wanted to bring new, fresh, additional capital and interest in Utah. And I think we've been somewhat successful in doing that.
Well, I looked at your portfolio. It's hard for you to name, you know, pick a few out. It's a lot easier for me as a third party. I brought with me, six names. Podium was the first on my list, which you've already talked about. And I'll just have you maybe choose one to just, you know, maybe talk about what it's been like to be an investor, you know, seeing them go through their ups and downs. But the six that I came in with me are Podium, Team, Owlet, who you talked about earlier, Homie, Weave, and Consensus.
Yeah.
Any of these stick out that you can say, hey, here's a great story. Here's how we were able to help them in a challenging time.
Yeah, I think that Podium is a great example, and my partner Sid Cromenhook deserves a lot of credit. He's been the board member and the lead at Podium. But again, it's been that was one of the very first deals we ever invested in our first fund. And it was, again, Eric Ray and Dennis Steele, the two founders. It was two guys came in and spoke to us. Hey, we have an idea. We have a little bit of technology. We have a trickle of revenue. And we're looking for some venture capital. And we obviously got to know them over a number of months and eventually, you know, wrote a term sheet and did a deal. We've seen them kind of move from their apartments where they were working from when we invested to a little bike shop in Provo, Provo Center Street, right over a little bike shop, a freezing cold office place. I remember going there in the winter. It was cold. They have a lot of funny stories about that place. But then for them to scale up and move to the point of the mountain and then build this big new building, you know, it's been an exhilarating ride. They've done an outstanding job of executing on their vision. And I think that Sid has leaned in extensively and added a lot to their early team. A lot of their early team outside of the founders are people within our network that we know and really trusted and liked and we thought could bring value to Podium. You know, we've helped strategically and on the board and otherwise. And so that's been a fantastic ride. Can I mention one more?
Oh, if it wasn't on my list, absolutely.
Well, it's Owlet. Can I talk a little bit more about Owlet?
Yeah, please do.
Owlet, Kurt
this
Workman.
This is one that a lot of listeners might be very interested in having themselves.
Yeah, it's a great product. Yeah, it's a great product. It's a smart booty or sock for infants that tracks certain important key kind of metrics or diagnostic on a infant and alert your phone if your baby's not breathing properly, et cetera. It's a great social product. But the point is I was on a panel at BYU 6 years ago or so with it was me, Greg Warnock, and Amy Rees Anderson, and it was a 1 minute speed pitch. There were literally 60 ideas from BYU students in 1 hour that were pitched to us in 1 minute, and then the three of us chose a winner, and we chose Owlet. And at that time, it was a 1 minute speed pitch. So we chose Owlet. I continued to be friends with Kurt for a year or two. And when we stood up our funds, we were one of the first investors in Owlet. And now, you know, the rest is, you can look up Owlet and read about them. But they've
and
gone
if you
from,
have an infant at home, you definitely should check
it
out. It's a very cool device. And it's iterated. You know, the first devices these things often are was a little clunky. It was proof of concept kind of idea. But now it makes total sense. If you have an infant at home, you definitely want to check it out. It's OWL, Owlet, OWL. O-W-L-E-T. And it's probably owlet.com.
Yeah, so that's been fun to see them go from not even their product working at the beginning, kind of like you said, to now, you know, tens of millions of annual sales and more going into retail, et cetera. And last thing I'll say, sorry, Doug, I could talk about these companies and these entrepreneurs forever, but in our second fund, you know, one of the latest investments we made is in a company called Divvy, Blake Murray and his team. It's a very exciting fintech startup here locally in Utah. I mean, there's just a number of exciting
Spence
opportunities.
Reports, right? It's not really the most exciting space, but they've built a really interesting business about it. And oftentimes, we need to take a quick break. Let me do that first, and I'll come back to that. If you're just joining us today, our guest today is Jeff Burningham. He is the co-founder of two firms, one that owns over $1 billion in apartment complexes, and another that does seed stage venture capital investments in the Intermountain West. Divvy, being in a it's in fintech, which right now is hot. I'm in the financial services business, so we've seen a lot of attention being paid from tech companies and financial services. But Divvy has kind of carved out this boring little niche that every company deals with, which is expense reports, which leads me to my next question. You know, there's a famous Wayne Gretzky has this quote about, you know, skating to where the puck's going to be. A lot of venture capitalists use that to talk about it's not the technologies that are hot today that are going to be successful and help the fund be successful. It's the technologies that are going to be hot in 3 or 5 years. Yep. What are some technologies that you're excited about now?
Yeah, it's a good question. Certainly blockchain. I mean, we've been looking at blockchain opportunities for the last several years. And there are a couple of interesting blockchain companies here in Utah, but not a lot of them. That's certainly not what we're known for now, but I think it'd be great if we continued to innovate in terms of, you know, the blockchain. That's obviously very interesting. I also think this whole, you know, kind of artificial AI is obviously very interesting. Again, very disruptive, very interesting, very cutting edge. What obviously Utah is known for is B2B SaaS, and there's still a lot of very interesting opportunities, we think, within B2B SaaS in kind of these niche markets. We funded a company in Fund 2 that's in the legal space that's very interesting. You know, law firms are still far behind kind of where they could be or what they should be in terms of software. And so we continue to fund B2B SaaS companies, and we continue to look forward, look ahead, and try to skate to where the puck is, like you said. And we're interested in large, kind of stagnant markets that are being disrupted by new technology. So these large markets are, you know, education, healthcare, even government, et cetera. We're really not thematic in our investing. We're looking for the best and kind of brightest entrepreneurs with the best ideas, tackling kind of the biggest problems or in the biggest markets. Those are the entrepreneurs we want to back.
Okay, great. Two last questions for you. Thank you, and I appreciate the time you've spent with us this morning.
It's been great. Thanks for having me.
The first of my wrap-up questions is talking about the Utah ecosystem. I talked earlier, at least on the real estate side, there were things that the legislature was doing 10 years ago that I think have made Utah a better place to live and work. Same thing on the ecosystem side. You guys were launching a fund in that period, brought more capital. There's been other venture capital firms that have come in and done the same thing. I think there's been a lot of heavy lifting in the last 10 years that has made this such an exciting place for entrepreneurs to start. What do you think we need to be thinking about today to get Utah to the next generation, the next place we'd like to be?
Yeah, I have two ideas that I'll share right off the top of my head. Number one is, you're right, there are a lot of other great venture funds in the state. And I think the more that these funds can work together collaboratively, I think a rising tide kind of raises all ships. And so I think that we can continue as a venture and technology startup ecosystem. I think the more that the venture funds can collaborate and work together, I think that's better. And that hasn't necessarily been super easy in the past. But although I think it is getting better, and we enjoy, you know, our relationships with the other venture funds, particularly we've done, I don't know how many deals we've done with Pelion, but probably Blake Modersitzky and his team have, I don't know, probably followed us into 10 or so deals that we've done. And we love working with those guys and all the other venture funds in the state. So I think more collaboration, because it's still a very small market. It's a tight market. And I think the more that we can work together, I think it's good for everyone. That's one kind of internal idea. Now an external idea that's an even bigger idea and is very important. I think there will, in the next decade, it will be easy for there to be even a larger separation between kind of the haves and the have-nots or income disparity based on tech. You are already seeing this along the Wasatch Front. And I, you know, myself as a business leader and as a community leader, I'm interested in dispersing the opportunity as that is here and is coming here as broadly as possible. I think we need to make sure that that we're not missing people, that everyone who wants a seat at the table of technology can have one if they want to. And I think we need to make sure that the opportunity isn't concentrated in this small group, but that the opportunity is spread and opened up to as many as possible. There's a lot of ways to do that. I'll mention just one is obviously education. We need to make sure that education in Utah is matching up with the jobs that are actually there and or are actually coming in technology, for instance. And that's not happening in a great way right now. We're missing a lot of opportunity to make sure that our children are educated in ways and around things that become very relevant and valuable in a technology-rich society and community like ours is becoming. So there's an idea. There's a couple ideas for you of what we can do.
I like those thoughts, yeah. I think they're both things. And hopefully people are listening, and I think they are. And I agree with you, the income disparity thing. I spend time in the Bay Area. And we want to be thoughtful on how we do that. So it builds the community. It doesn't divide the community.
Correct, yeah.
My last question for you. One of the things I notice is you've been on the board of a not-for-profit. It's called Sunshine Heroes Foundation. Mm-hmm. You've been on the board for a long time, over 10 years there. Tell us what they do and why that's a cause that you've dedicated as much of your time to that you have.
Yeah, I appreciate that. There are several boards, that nonprofit boards that I've been on. The Sunshine Heroes board in particular was started by a good friend of mine, Travis Hansen, former BYU basketball player and then played in the NBA for the Atlanta Hawks. Went on and had a great career in Russia and Spain over in Europe. And Sunshine Heroes is focused on children. My wife is an elementary education major. She taught second grade before we were married and had children. And so we have four children ourselves. We're passionate about children, and we think that the Sunshine Heroes Foundation does a great job in empowering kids both locally here in Utah. They do a number of things with the Boys and Girls Club and other things. And then also internationally. I was fortunate enough to be able to take my family a couple Thanksgivings ago down to Panama and build kind of a children's center in Panama for the Sunshine Heroes. And it was a safe place for kids to go where they could get a good meal, have very moderate, simple health care, and also just a safe place to learn and grow, a lot of books and physical activities there. There was a little skate park and basketball hoop, et cetera. And so that's, you know, Travis and Larry Hansen are good friends of ours. We love the work that they're doing at Sunshine Heroes. And that's one of many good charities and causes, not-for-profits, that are blossoming up and that we've kind of done our best to support. So that's one we really have enjoyed.
Yeah, it's one of the favorite parts of doing these interviews is just finding things outside of the business world that people are passionate about and giving back. So thank you for your service to that organization. And thank you for sharing your story with us today on The Bottom Line.
Thank you, Doug.
Our guest this morning has been Jeff Burningham, co-founder and managing director of Peak Capital Partners, a private equity firm that owns and manages conventional, affordable student and family apartment properties in growth markets across the United States. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Christian Camargo. Thank you, Christian. You can hear my entire interview with Jeff Burningham on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Bottom Line podcast. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.